From unknown parts of metropolitan New York City, I am the hip and this is Lee.
A little twist on that opening. Yes. Hello. Hello. Good evening or good morning. Good afternoon. Whenever you might be listening. This is, of course, Hip and the Lip, a New York sports podcast, indeed, on another sweltering summer day here in the Big Apple. Oh, my God, it's awful out there. Oof. Can't wait for summer to end, football to come, the winter sports to come, and, you know, the baseball playoffs, all that. But until then, we have the trade deadline and all the boring dullness of the summer as we just await training camp to start, right? That's what everybody is so amped up for, the start of NFL training camps, in only about a week or so. How about that? But yes,
well,
we got,
the fantasy football debates are a plenty. Oh my gosh, that's a huge difference on who you pick number one. You know, unless you get to go number two, you're like season's over if you can't go number one. It's so important to get that first pick right. Oh gosh, just ignore all that, please. What a waste of time. I see that stuff advertised. I'm like, I don't even want to read it. I don't care. It's all about who you get in the later rounds, please.
Oh, yes.
We'll get to that in future episodes, yes. I'll give away all my sleepers, and I'll still win. I don't care.
I'm sorry.
Thanks for the...
What place did you come in last year, Mr. Hip? I'm sorry.
It's whatever cares about it. Last year was a rough year with injuries, of course.
Yes, of course. It's always the injuries.
Excuses.
Yes, always so convenient to blame the injuries.
The Yankees just made a big trade. They still have another 11 days to maybe make another big trade or two. There's rumors swirling. We'll get to that.
Yep.
Will that be enough for the Yankees to rebound from their continued swoon? The Mets for 30 seconds. The Knicks.
Yes, indeed.
Of detail, if you will. We're going to talk about how sports betting may be relevant far more than you think in the United States in the not too distant future. We'll break that all down. Some interesting legal issues, different parties at play with stake in the action. I think it's a very interesting topic, especially during this part of the sports season where we're a little too early to get too much into the NFL. And, you know, we just have the baseball to cover. So let's get to that. Look, the Yankees acquired, I should say reacquired. Well, they didn't reacquire Robertson because he was a Yankee product originally. So David Robertson's now back on the Yankees from the Chicago White Sox. They also grabbed a second reliever, Conley. Is that how it's pronounced? Conley?
Yeah,
and
something like that.
Todd Frazier, who's slated to play third base, could play first base too, so it's good flexibility to give this team a boost. What was your immediate reaction when you saw that this deal was done?
I was taken aback, to be honest. I mean, I didn't think it was going to come this quickly. We knew that the Yankees were in play. You know, we talked about that. We all expected that they would make some kind of move, whether it was going to be a minor move, maybe bring in like a number four or five pitcher, like a Drew Smyly or a Trevor Cahill, yes. Or if they were going to make a little bit of a bigger move. And this is a big move. I mean, you know, when you break this down, this is a team, this is a move that screams that this is a team that is looking to win now. And this is what I like about this deal, because we've talked about the perception of what the Yankees have been doing since last year. And the Yankees will never admit this, because that's not the Yankee way to say that they're in the middle of a rebuild, because rebuild is not part of the Yankee lexicon. We know that. And the Yankees had their own version of a rebuild going on here by having the kids come up and play this year. And what did we say last week? We expected them to win, what, 82, 83, mid-80s wins, you know, would be like the high watermark for them for this year. And instead, and now they have hit us, they have hit a malaise. They have struggled over the last, like, month. They've really struggled. And, you know, they've lost a lot of ground in the standings. They sit right now two back of Boston for the division. You know, they hold the second wild card spot, but there are six teams within four of the lost column of the Yankees, so it's going to be a tight race the rest of the year. But I like the move because it says, hey, we're not going to destroy our farm system by trading away, you know, prospects numbers one, two, four, five, and six. but we can give away a decent prospect because we have a deep farm system, and we're still in the business of winning. And that's the one thing that you like about the Yankees. All the criticism that we have given them, that they have gotten from, you know, wherever over the last however many years with the way they've handled things, done things, the team still has a commitment to winning that you cannot say about every team. Forget about, in professional sports throughout the country. Just look at our fair city here, the Jets, the Knicks. I mean, you can go down the line with teams that you always question their commitment to winning. The Yankees will always have that commitment, and this move exemplifies that. They bring back Robertson, obviously a familiar face to Yankee fans. You know, he's an above-average reliever. He's supposed to, I guess, spell Chapman potentially, you know, to close out games if Chapman is tired. You know, if he throws like six pitches in a game, oh, no, I'm tired. You know, I can't pitch anymore. I need a couple days off. Obviously, Frazier's a guy that's going to hit home runs. He's a guy that's going to not hit for a high average, as we know. He's hitting 207 or whatever he's hitting right now. But I guess his BABIP says he's due for an uptick, right? Yes. And then the guy that was an unknown, I'm sure, to most Yankee fans, and including myself, despite my involvement in fantasy, is that Cannell guy. Kenil Cannell, however you pronounce his name.
I think it's Conley.
Former Yankee. Oh, Conley? Is that how you pronounce it?
Okay. K-A-H-N-L-E. Conley.
Okay. See how much I know. So Conley,
we'll see. A guy. I think.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, we'll look it up and we'll get back to you. But a guy that is a former Yankee that they lost in the Rule 5 draft, like, what was it, 4 years ago or something like that. He's a guy that obviously is 27 years old. He's developed into one of the top relievers, at least for this year, one of the best relief pitchers in the game. He has a K-to-walk ratio of 62-7 in 37 innings, averages 15.9 strikeouts per nine innings. And a lot of scouts, I guess, think that this is going to be the key guy to the trade, not the two big names that you're familiar with in Robertson and Frazier. So I like the move. They gave up a good prospect in Rutherford. I guess Clarkson, the pitcher, is supposed to be a decent prospect too. But you know what? You're going to have to give up something to get something. And honestly, I think that this is a move that is going to help the Yankees going down the stretch. Is it going to put them over the top to be the favorites to represent the American League in the World Series? No, but at least at a minimum, they fortify their lineup. They fortify their bullpen. Their bullpen on paper right now looks just astronomically deep when you and now add those two guys to what they had. And, you know, Frazier gives them a right-handed power bat, not that they needed one, considering all the right-handed power that they already possess. But, you know, I like the trade. I like the fact that they're going for it, and it sends a positive message to the fans. Hey, fans, don't just think that we're just going to let the season go by the wayside because we played lousy over the last month. We still think that we have enough here to make a run. We're going for it, and I like it.
All right. Actions speak louder than words when it comes to a team's commitment to winning. That being said, Brian Cashman did apparently thank the Steinbrenners for their willingness to take on the Robertson contract, which is like $15 million a year or something through
one more
year
after this year. And you know, Robertson, look, he's not a great relief pitcher, but he's still a useful relief pitcher, and he's familiar with the terrain. You know, he's proven that he can, you know, especially we remember him for being like Houdini in situations where he has bases loaded or guys on base and he somehow can get out of it. He still strikes guys out. And, you know, he's not going to be the closer. We know that, even though if he might spell Chapman. But, hey, I like the move. And, again, it says to Yankee fans, continue to come out to the ballpark because we are going to try and get into the playoffs.
So. As far as other moves the Yankees might make, I think at this point they just need to, you know, and the rumors already out there is add a starting pitcher. Show Michael Pineda, done for the year. Tommy John surgery, might miss all of next year.
He's done.
And Pineda had been showing warning signs via his performance in recent starts for Pineda. And maybe this is something that's been bothering him for a handful of starts already. I think they only discovered it during the All-Star break, during like a routine physical. This wasn't something that he like threw a pitch, his arm, like, you know, his elbow felt like it fell off and they discovered it. This was strange, actually. Nevertheless, this rotation now is looking average at best. I think I don't see how you could even argue any better, and that's relying on Severino continuing to be basically a number one, because I don't know if you can what to expect from Tanaka. He's still surrendering the home runs. I mean, it's mix and match after that, right? I mean, Jordan Montgomery's a rookie. Yeah. You can't they're not going to let him throw 200 innings.
No,
so that's another issue.
Yeah, I think they're going to bring in somebody. I'd be surprised if they don't bring in. It's not going to be a big name. They're not going to bring in Verlander or some of the other big name pitchers that have been thrown out there. But you know, they'll probably bring in a. You know, I don't know, you saw Estrada's name in a Toronto thrown out there. Sonny Gray's name continues to swirl around. Maybe Trevor Cahill. There are a couple guys that they wouldn't have to give up big prospects to get, and I'm sure that they'll bring in somebody. I'd be surprised if they don't. But you know, with the depth that their bullpen possesses right now, they don't need anybody. They don't need to bring in a big starter. They can just ask their starters that they have, hey, go out and give us five, think about six, five decent innings. I mean, if you're pitching
but
well,
you know what? I don't care how deep your bullpen is. You can't get five innings from every starter.
Your bullpen
will collapse down the stretch. They need to add an innings eater. And the guy that I like, who I would be surprised if anyone on this who's listening to this has heard of him, he's actually pitching right now. It's either Julius or Julius Chacin on the San Diego Padres.
Not Cahill. That's
this guy's an innings eater. He doesn't strike everyone out, but he's an innings eater. 4.29 ERA on the season. Obviously not phenomenal, but he's actually pitched really well since early June. He's not going to. Well, I mean, he has 92 strikeouts in 108 innings. That's not terrible. He's an innings eater, though. He's a guy that'll go out there and give you six, seven innings. And
he's a guy that can help.
They need a guy who can at least eat up some innings, because the rest of the staff with the Cessas and I don't even know who's getting starts these days. Like, who's battling for the who's taking Pineda's spot? I don't even know if it's the term. It's Sabathia's back, right? They have Sabathia's back.
Yeah. I mean, Cessa's gonna he's gonna make his next. He started the other day. He's going to get another start.
Yeah.
They have Green that they can give a start to. They like him in the bullpen, but he can get a start. I mean, look, they're going to piecemeal it together at least for right now, unless they bring in somebody. And
they're going to add. They got to add somebody if they want to be serious about making a run here. They need to add somebody.
But it's not like they're going to say like this. I mean, if Severino's pitching well, he's going to pitch deep into the game. If Tanaka's pitching well, he'll pitch deep into the game. It's your fourth and fifth, whether it's a Sessa or whoever, that, again, you're just going to ask them to give you five decent innings. If they can give you more, wonderful. But you're not going to need those guys to do that if, you know, as long as you're, again, Tanaka and Severino can give you, a little depth in the
I don't feel games, great about
but they have
them.
A lot of depth. But they have a lot of depth in their
They
bullpen.
Do, but I don't feel great about Tanaka and Severino relying on them to go deep into all their games. I think that's a safe assumption based on what we've seen.
Yeah, but they don't need. But again, as long as their bullpen is performing to their capability, and now they have like four, five really solid, good, reliable guys. I mean, unless Roberts is going to come in here and implode, which I don't expect. Warren still is a very reliable arm. They love what he can do out of the bullpen, and he's invaluable to what they like the way they like to use their bullpen. You know, Betances now all of a sudden has been the subject of trade rumors, which they've squashed very quickly. Cashman and company, always on the block. We're not looking to trade him. You might see him dealt in the offseason. I wouldn't be surprised if you saw that happen, just because of still the hurt feelings between him and the team. And plus, he's going to end up commanding a lot of money, but that's for another day. But the depth in their bullpen allows them to be able to. Even if their starting pitching is not giving you, a lot of length and a lot of, quality innings, as long as they give you enough quality within, within whatever kind of confine you want to set it to, their bullpen is good enough and now deep enough that they are going to be able to still win games as long as their offense picks it up, because their offense has really struggled now over the last like couple of weeks. They slowed down after their torrid stretch there in June. Really it's over a month now that they've just been very erratic, very inconsistent, and they've really struggled recently. And if their offense doesn't pick it up, then it's a moot point anyway, because they'll even if they squeak into the playoffs, it'll be as a second wild card.
Judge has done nothing, and it's all because of the home run derby, I'm sure.
Yeah, of course. Blame the home run derby. Yes.
Since the start of the second half, yes.
Well, their offense is real. Well, he's slumped, but we knew he was going to slump. He was not going to continue, you know, that pace that he was on early in the season. You knew he was going to.
It's the home run derby. I mean, you look at every other guy that was in the home run derby, they've all been terrible.
Oh, yes. Miguel Sano has been awful, right? Only
as is Giancarlo Stanton's been the worst of all of them. He's only hit like 5 home runs since the home run.
Yes, and Sano continues to kill the Yankees. I think he has like 5 home runs and 9 career games against the Yankees now or something, Sano. So maybe the new Manny Ramirez.
Let's talk about the 7 games under 500 New York Mets, 11 games out of the wild card. Dare I even – well, it's 13 and a half out of first place. Which is not.
Yeah. I mean, right now, who cares about them? It's like, who cares?
So, I mean, well, how about this? Like, I felt like this was a new low for this team. And it wasn't even, it was on-field play. The Mets were trying to rally on Monday night against the Cardinals. They cut the lead down, the deficit down to 6-3. I think it was 6-0. Down to 6-3. They get 2 men on, 1 out. In the bottom of the ninth, Yoenis, and he works a 3-0 count. So there's 2 on, 1 out, 3-0 count, down 3. And the announcers are talking about, you know, Gary Cohen, Keith Hernandez, does he have the green light here? And I think to myself, sure, he's going to ground into a game-ending double play. Next pitch.
Sure enough.
Next pitch, high and you know, on the a little bit up, but on the outer part of the plate, he pulls a ground ball right to the shortstop. Of course, he can't run. Easy game-ending double play. See ya. Good night. Game over. Never done it in a couple games here against the Cardinals, but we'll see what they do for the trade deadline. We'll next show go through all of that and you know see what this team is looking like in the future. You know, they're Syndergaard and Harvey, I think, threw on Monday. This is what causes excitement for this team.
Who cares?
In this fan base. But that's what's worth reporting on at this point. What's getting headlines. And that's all you need to know.
And I'm not necessarily a believer that they have to be just shut down the rest of the year. I'm not necessarily a believer in that. I would say Harvey's a guy that you're going to be a lot more cautious with. I mean, if Syndergaard is healthy and he's able to pitch, then pitch. Then have him pitch. That's what his job is. I mean, it's not like he's 30.
It's not an arm injury anyway. It's not an elbow injury. It was his lat. Let him come back at a reasonable pace and he's ready to
rush
pitch
him. Obviously, you don't have to rush him back. There's no point for that. But if he's healthy and he can pitch, then pitch. Now, none of this, we're just going to shut him down for the rest of the year because, well, why not? No. Nonsense. He's still a young guy. He's not like he's 35 years old. He's not a veteran in this league. He still needs to continue to build up his experience, have him come back and pitch. Harvey, I'm not even going to comment on Harvey because I really have no idea what his situation is. I mean, you mentioned the muscle atrophy and going on in his arm last episode. So, who the hell knows what's going on with him? So I'm not even going to comment on him, but yeah, the Mets, again, talk to me when they trade their first guy, and you're wondering when that will happen. I mean, they have so many guys that you figure Sandy is shopping. So, talk to me when they trade their first guy. I'm not going to talk about any wins or losses with them because there's no point unless they all of a sudden want to go on a streak where they win like 15 of 18 or something, but which I think is slim to none. So,
yep.
Until they trade their first guy, whatever. The Mets, again, are a dull, boring, lifeless baseball team where right now, if you're a Mets fan, you have no reason to go to that ballpark to watch that team unless DeGrom is on the hill. If he's on the hill, you got a reason. If he's not, there's no reason. So that's
speaking of no reason, how about your New York Knicks?
Yes, no reason indeed. No rhyme or reason to anything that goes on in that building. Yeesh. The development since our last show is the new GM. Oh, my God. So exciting, right? Scott Perry. I'm sure that most people, maybe even if they have heard the name, knew really very little about him.
Steve Perry, to be mistaken.
No, yes, not Steve Perry. Yes, the immortal Scott Perry, who has been in the league for a long time, was actually hired only a few months ago by the Sacramento Kings as their VP of basketball operations. only to be snatched by the Knicks a few months later. So the Knicks had to give like a second round conditional draft pick to the Kings to be able to hire him. But I mean, a guy that has been, you know, the block multiple times in this league. He's actually a former Michigan assistant coach, and has been with the Magic, has been with the Pistons, has been with the Supersonics for a year. I think he was actually part of the staff that drafted Kevin Durant. Not that it's, you know, that was a, you know, something that deserves a pat on the back. That was very much a no-brainer decision. But, you know, he's a guy that has experience. He's a guy that's a basketball guy, unlike Steve Mills, who I said last time was going to end up being named the president. Sure enough, he's president now, you know, team president, whatever that means. We don't know exactly what that means and what kind of capacity he's going to, you know, have his hands on the basketball decisions. The, you know, the things have to go through him. Is this what, did they bring in Perry because he's a guy without really, even though he has an extensive resume, it's not a very overly impressive resume because he's never been the guy before. Now he's supposedly the guy, but again, what does that mean? Does he have full autonomy with basketball decisions? Does he have to go through Mills, who has never been a basketball guy, was brought in here as a numbers, finance, marketing guy all those years ago, and I guess all of a sudden now is a basketball guy because he's made decision or he's been involved with decisions? Again, we have no idea what's going on in that front office. We have no idea how the hierarchy works, is going to work going forward now with this front office the way it's constructed. And, you know, the Carmelo thing, obviously, I mean, that saga, until he gets traded or until they say he's off the block, he's going to be a Knick next year. It's like, I can't even be bothered with it. The rumors, the Twitter-ing by all players of Portland and Houston, oh, we want him here, we want him here. It's just, it's gotten to the point where it's just like, just get away from me with this nonsense. I have no patience to listen to all this nonsense. Until something happens or until a declarative statement is made by the Knicks that he's staying, whatever. It's the Knicks are going to be a disaster next year. We know that. They're going to be awful. Exactly. It's going to be W gas really for who knows how long now, that they have such a long way to go before they will be even remotely relevant on the NBA landscape. So whatever. I don't know if you have any comment thoughts on the hire, but it's not exactly.
Not really. W gas.
Yeah, all right. A guy that they can control, a guy that they can say, yeah, you know what, you're Scott Perry. Who the hell are you to actually command anything or, you know, try to exert, you know, authority within the organizations?
So let's talk about something that it's kind of shifting gears a little. A topic that recently off there, and I think is very, it's been going on for more than 5 years. This is the possibility of sports betting expanding, legal sports betting expanding in the United States. So most of us already know that you can go bet on a line in a Las Vegas sports book, right? Right. You can't do it. You can't do it in New York. You can't do it in New Jersey. You can't do it in California. Anywhere else, in fact. You can do it in Delaware, but it's only a parlay. Oregon and Montana also were grandfathered in. I don't even know what the betting schemes are there on sports betting. Outside of those four states, it is illegal to wager on the outcome of a sporting event in the United States. Okay. And that is based on a federal statute called the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act of 1992. Why am I saying all this? Because the Supreme Court of the United States, the highest court in the land of the home of the, and the free and of the brave.
Yes, indeed. The appeal court, of course.
Okay. they granted certiorari of a very interesting legal case, the plaintiff being, well, I should say the petitioner, for cert being a character that we discuss, a political figure that we discussed ad nauseum last episode, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie.
Yep. Always in the news, that guy.
And the adversary in the case is the NCAA and the four primary professional sports leagues. Now, it was Governor Christie, on behalf of the state of New Jersey, that went to the Supreme Court to ask for an appeal of a case that was lost at the Third Circuit level. And the case basically involves New Jersey's attempt to legalize sports betting within its borders. This is the second go-around that they've taken to try to legalize sports betting. The, in 2014, they passed a law that basically says, we, the state of New Jersey, are repealing our own sports betting ban. So the state of New Jersey had its own law in the books that said, we don't allow sports betting in our state either. Like a specific law for the state, not just the federal law that has effect in New Jersey. They repealed that law and authorized sports betting to occur at the Atlantic City casinos and racetracks in the state without the state's oversight. This has been the issue that's been litigated since 2014, so that New Jersey passed a law, and then the professional sports leagues filed a lawsuit against New Jersey, preventing them from moving forward with that law on the books, basically saying, you can't, we think that this is a violation of federal law, the Professional Amateur Sports Protection Act. You can't, federal law supersedes state law under the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Okay?
Right.
So now, what's really significant about this is the Supreme Court of the United States agreeing to hear the case. That's what granting certiorari means. So if a tax, I always say, I'm so used to saying taxpayer, and it's, you're going to probably hear it again a few more times. I really mean to say a party to a case. I'm just, it's just the IRS adversarial nature coming out of me.
So what hipster's day job is, yes.
When one loses in court at the circuit level, which is the second, which is really the first appellate level at in the federal court system, the next level and really the only level to go up to is the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court doesn't agree to hear every case that is brought before it. That's what the writ of certiorari is. It's basically a request for the Supreme Court to hear the case. And in order for the Supreme Court to agree to hear it, at least four of the nine justices that sit on the Supreme Court must vote to grant certiorari. So that means at least four of the nine justices, maybe more, believe that New Jersey's case warrants a close look. Now, what's significant about this is the percentage of cases that the Supreme Court actually agrees to hear every year. Any idea what that percentage is?
I know it's a very, very low, low percentage. If I had a guess, I would say, what is it, like around like 3 or 4% or something?
Nope. It's more like 1% to 2%.
Damn.
So one or two out of every 100 cases that are merely petitioned to be heard are granted. Others, they're denied, and that's, and the case pretty much, that's where the case dies. So New Jersey's case could have died if the Supreme Court agreed, if they denied cert. Okay, so it's seen as a huge development for New Jersey's chances because they had lost at every other stage in the in this case, at the federal, at the district court level, at the circuit court level, and then at the circuit court level, they actually requested what's called an en banc hearing, which means, so the federal circuit court typically has three judges per case that decide. So it's, you know, they just vote 2-1 or 3-0. En banc hearing is when every single judge on the Third Circuit, in this case the Third Circuit, weighs in on the case and will vote. And they actually agreed to the it's rare for them to even agree to that, the circuit court, but they did, and they still turned down New Jersey thereafter. So they've lost every step of the way. So what really is the key legal issue in this case, right? So you have a federal statute that basically says it's unlawful for a governmental entity like a state to operate sports betting in their state. That's the heart of it. You could read it, Google this Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act of 1992, but that's basically what it says. when it was passed, there was a grandfathering clause that allowed any state that wanted to legalize it in the interim to keep that intact. That's why New Jersey still has and dominates the sports betting book industry legally on the legal side to this day.
Right. And it's one question though. And I mean, everybody knows that's, you know, that gambling is illegal. Everybody knows that sports gambling, everybody's familiar with that. The question, and you know, this is, I guess, sort of relevant. What was the impetus for this to begin with? What was it that the federal government felt that they had to step in and enact a federal law that says that states are not allowed to, you know, to operate any kind of, you know, sports gambling operation within the state? I mean, is it just like basically like a moral clause? Like, oh, it's immoral to gamble, so therefore it's illegal, you know, kind of like drugs or something like that? Or is there something more to it? What is it? I mean, it's very relevant anyway. But
the arguments that are made now for essentially why New Jersey has been stopped from moving forward with this law while this case is being heard, because the NCAA, et cetera, obtained an injunction against New Jersey to stop them from moving forward with this while the legal issue is decided, is it would cause irreparable harm to move forward. So you think to yourself, what is the irreparable harm? And the arguments, the primary argument that is put forth, and I don't know how the attorneys that represent the sports leagues make it with a straight face, is that it would threaten the integrity of the game or games.
Which I guess we'll get into the extreme hypocrisy with that. That is just, like you said, how they make that with a straight face is beyond me.
A different time. There was really no internet back in 1992. Very, very, very basic level of internet. And I just think that they wanted to, I guess they just didn't want rampant gambling throughout the country on sports. I think that's right. Nothing more to, I don't think there's any like secret reason to this.
Okay. I know that what is the key more on a lot of, you know, laws that are on the books, you know, especially when you look at our drug laws and all that. I mean, really stem from the fact that it's just considered to be, you know, immoral to engage in the act of gambling. But all right, well, I guess you're going to get to this. My next question would be, at least for me personally, is this more of a states' rights issue, or is this more of a, this law is unconstitutional, it violates the Constitution, we're challenging it in the Supreme Court? Or is it kind of like go part and parcel, hand in hand, or is it more one over the other?
It is part and parcel.
Okay.
Issue. And I think that's why it has a lot of significance being granted by, with the certiorari being granted by the Supreme Court, because the decision is not just going to have an impact on this specific case, but it's going to weigh in significantly on the scope of how much the Constitution can impact states' abilities to exercise their police power. We say police power, meaning the state, like, so under the U.S. Constitution, unless an action of Congress is specifically authorized, they can't issue. States are different. States have a general police power. They can pass any law they want, provided it's not that in violation of the federal
law. Right, right.
Exactly. Or it pretty much. So,
but that's why the states in this case can't pass. They can pass legislation that says gambling's okay, because like you said, that's in violation of federal law.
Well, that's the key legal issue in the case.
Okay. The anti-commandeering doctrine.
How'd you know? Yes, the anti-commandeering doctrine.
We discussed it on our car ride down to Delaware about a week and a half ago. So I do remember that very vividly.
It's derived from the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which reads verbatim, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people." That in of itself kind of summarizes what we said just before. The U.S. Constitution doesn't cover something that the states can do, then they can't violate the states' rights. So in case law, limited case law, the anti-commandeering doctrine says that Congress can't order states to adopt a regulatory scheme. The federal government itself has not adopted a relevant scheme. Say that again so you can digest that.
I have to say it like three or four
Congress,
times.
The anti-commandeering doctrine bars Congress from ordering states to adopt a particular regulatory scheme when the federal government itself has not adopted a relevant scheme. This
so the
is
federal
the
government
doctrine.
Has to adopt the scheme first before that they can tell the states that they can't do it.
Right. And so This is what New Jersey's position is primarily based upon. They claim that PASPA, which is the acronym for the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, commandeers New Jersey to prohibit sports betting under New Jersey law. That it's forcing New Jersey to not... It's in the same vein, it's basically PASPA is interfering with the sovereignty of states to decide whether sports betting should be lawful or not. That is the core of the argument. Okay.
That's
now,
right.
What...
And that obviously is not just Jersey. That's every state except for Nevada and...
Yeah,
Delaware and
absolutely. Right, which right. gets to the point that if New Jersey prevails, the dominoes will fall.
Yeah, how many
very,
other states?
Very, very quickly. There's states that are passing their legislation now in anticipation of PASPA being ruled unconstitutional. They're
really?
they're doing it in advance.
Wow.
What do the leagues say? Their basic position is that it doesn't obligate New Jersey to adopt any scheme. It just blocks New Jersey from legalizing sports betting. It doesn't require. So this is like, it's how do you really interpret the anti-commandeering doctrine? Because the says Congress can't order states to adopt a scheme. So New Jersey's saying PASPA is ordering us to not have sports betting, where the leagues say, no, it just says that you're not required to adopt a scheme. You're just being blocked from doing something. You're not being ordered not to do something. You're just being told. I mean, but that's really what this comes down to, believe it or not.
Yeah, and when you think about like the core legal issue, I mean, I guess nobody would ever think that the sports gambling issue comes down to like the, you know, the legal intricacies the way you just spelled them out there. I mean, I never thought of it like that ever.
Does the federal ban on sports betting compel a state to act? That's New Jersey's argument. Or does it prevent the state from acting? That is what the leagues argue. is what it comes down to.
Well, they're just basically in debt. I mean, they're interpreting the law, right? They're saying that, the federal statute's on the books, so they are not commandeering the state's rights to enact it. I mean, they're just going to... Right?
Well,
and they're just,
you know, how the judges will rule based on, you know, what political party they kind of lean towards, you know. Thing is, it's
well,
not...
What is the liberal... I guess the conservative position is gambling bad, right? So that means the conservative judges will probably
lean but you know
gambling
what?
Bad.
This is above gambling. I mean, if you think about it, that's...
But right, but then you factor in states' rights, right? And the conservative... side is all about states' rights. The liberal side is more about giving more power, or you know, just if you just break it down in terms of ideology, you know, liberal side is more about, you know, giving more power to the federal government to, you know, enact more federal programs or to enact more federal statutes and supersede states' rights, whereas conservative side is the other tact. So I guess the question is, it's almost like they're gonna like be conflicted. It's gonna be like the inner conflict with all the judges. Like, and they're going to have to apply, instead of just leaning towards their liberal conservative side, they're going to actually have to apply their legal expertise to this. I mean, this is a legitimate constitutional question. It looks like this is posing.
That's what it is. I mean, that's what it exactly is. Yes. And look, you're right that it, if you want to say that this is a more, you know, it states' rights, conservative. Okay. I mean, I guess, look, the current Supreme Court is conservative on balance. They don't like the federal government overreaching. Kennedy is often viewed as a swing vote. He tends to lean conservative. He has expressed in commentary that he's kind of a states' rights guy. I'm not saying how the case, but it goes back to the, you know, we have to remember that New Jersey has lost every single step of the way in this case.
The Supreme Court
will agree, but none of the lower level courts have had the balls, basically, is what I think it is, to come out and say, you know what, New Jersey, I think you might have this right. I don't care how much money is behind the professional sports leagues and all the ramifications. I just, part of me thinks that the judges are almost a little too afraid to go the other way and punt and say, you know what, you could go to the next level and overrule me. That's fine. I'd rather have it go that way than me rule in favor of New Jersey, set off this chain reaction, you know, in the media and with, you know, this kind of, you know, new legal issue, setting this precedent only to get then overturned by the Supreme Court, where they rule against that lower judge and go back to square one. So as far as timing goes, you're not next year. If I had to guess at this point, maybe early next year. Because they have to submit briefs to the Supreme Court, they have to have oral arguments, and then they have to decide and write an opinion. So you know, I think you're talking almost a year still.
You may not see this like until like June or something of next year, right? I mean, it might be almost like a full year before we get a ruling on this.
But if New Jersey loses, real recourse that remains is to get the federal law itself repealed. PASPA has to get repealed. Because if that gets repealed, then there's no federal ban on sports betting.
Well, how do you get it repealed? Well, I mean, once it's on the books?
Well, yeah, you have Congress vote to repeal it. You know, because they agree on so many other issues.
I mean, considering all the other
cities. Exactly. At this point,
I mean, I'm sure that's at the bottom of their priorities list, I would think.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
This has been a law that's been on the books for a while, and it's just been universally accepted as, you know, gambling's illegal except in these states. And, you know, I mean, like, you know, I mean, look, from our
perspective, New Jersey will be hurt by this, obviously, if they lose, if the sports leagues prevail here.
We'll lose this on the, so on much. I mean, just like the extra revenue that they've been counting on, like what are they, we've been counting on to get this additional revenue by
forever. Yeah, of course. They're entitled. They should be entitled to it forever. No other state should be entitled to sports betting revenue. That's not fair.
Of course, absolutely. I mean, look, professional sports leagues, you know, they just say, we want our cut. We don't make it legal. That's fine. We want our cut. How do we get in here? We want a piece of the action. That's all we care about, you know, because we don't believe that this is going to get repealed. We don't believe the Supreme Court, like you said, they've lost everywhere in New Jersey. We don't believe the Supreme Court's going to come in now and overturn the law and say it's unconstitutional. Therefore, why the hell wouldn't we fight against it? Especially, you know, if we have no way of getting it on the action. Oh, wait, we are in on the action already. We're already heavy investors in FanDuel and DraftKings and those the daily fantasy sports betting. So the gambling, which they of course say is not gambling, which we all know it is.
Look, the NFL, these sports leagues make so much money because of people who do fantasy, because of people who do illegal sports betting. They know it. They know that it's coming, sports betting.
Well, Adam,
it's more
Adam
matter Silver's of how.
It seems like he's a proponent of it. I mean, he's basically said, and he was quoted a couple of days ago.
So he has – here's the thing. Yes, he talks about it. He's the most – I would say he's the most level-headed about it as far as comments go. But remember, the NBA is a party to this case. He's the commissioner of the NBA. They're still trying to stop New Jersey from doing this. So as much as he wants to talk about sports betting coming, it's not like he's running around being an advocate.
No, he's for legalized sports betting. He's being he's not
realistic.
I mean, he's expecting it to come.
He is, but he's not. Let's not say he's all in, because I saw a tweet today from Darren Revell, and he said that Adam Silver is all in on sports betting. If Adam Silver were all in on sports betting, Adam Silver would be in the halls of Congress advocating for this, advocating for the repeal of PASPA. He hasn't done that. He's more cheering on the sidelines. Not, I don't even want to say cheering. He's expressing an openness to something that's inevitable.
Well, we think it's inevitable. I mean, it's...
With nothing more. Yeah, but he's not being proactive other than to talk about it in interviews. So to say that he's all in, I'm not saying that you said that, but to see that remark, I think is misleading. He might be more all in compared to the other commissioners.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well,
so that's
always been, though. I mean, he's really, since day one, since he's taken over for David Stern, he has basically come out and, I mean, he has been kind of propagating this now for really since his initiation as commissioner of the NBA. And, you know, like you said, he may not be an advocate of legalizing sports gambling, but at the same time, he definitely is somebody that is very forward-thinking, that is very progressive, probably the most progressive out of all the commissioners. And I think he is just kind of preparing for it because he, I guess, expects it to be.
Look, maybe the Goodells of the world, maybe behind closed doors, they realize this is happening too. They're just not going to be so forthcoming with acknowledging that in public. All right, good enough. We'll come back to this case in a year. I mean, it's probably going to take that long, realistically. Maybe a little less, not before the end of the year. All right, let's transition out.
Thought that I have is, you think about like how much like illegal sports gambling is done in this country every year. I mean, it's got to be, you know, it might even be into the billions at this point. I mean, who knows? It's just like, it's gotten to a point of just absurdity. You know, it goes on. You know what? Just legalize it already. I mean, it's like, you know, putting aside whatever stupid arguments, you know, that the professional sports leagues has, you know, putting aside even the legal arguments about states' rights and the 10th Amendment and all that, you know, just if you just look at it logically, you just say, hey, you know what? Really, what is the risk? What is the harm that this is going to bring? We know integrity of the game is nonsense. It's crap. So I'm not even going to entertain that. You think about what the harm is to legalizing sports gambling. You know, if you want to say that there's underlying issues to it, regulating it, you know, I understand. And, you know, obviously it can be an addiction. You know, a lot of people are addicted to gambling in this country. But you know what? That addiction is, I don't know if that's necessarily going to spread. That addiction's there. It's been there for a very, very long time for a lot of people, because gambling is legal in a lot of parts of this country, whether you talk about sports gambling or otherwise. So at this point, on the surface, I would say it just makes sense to just get rid of the law, legalize it, let whatever states want to legislate it, let them legislate it, let them open up casinos or whatever, sports books, whatever they want to open up, and just finally just stop this charade that's been going on in this country now for 25 years. That's it.
Julius Chacin update. He is a 3 1/3 shutout innings so far tonight, so we'll see.
Maybe a potential Yankee, former Padre, potential Yankee, yes.
Nobody will be able to pronounce his name, but who cares?
Well, the Yankees had a Sean Chacon. Remember, they acquired a deadline, I want to say, like maybe a decade ago, a Sean Chacon from Colorado.
I don't know. I'm tempted to hijack the hipster moment of Zenith because coming back to the Yankees, I forgot to mention this. Clint Frazier and having to cut his hair. I mean, seriously? Seriously? Yeah.
Batting
Did you notice this?
Trim those sideburns. That's the Yankee way.
No, it wasn't his sideburns. It was his mullet.
No,
I mean, come on.
My Simpsons reference.
Because he had that walk-off home run against the Brewers two Saturdays ago. I think it was two Saturdays ago because it was a day game. He had that walk-off home run, and the next time I saw him, it was the typical buzz cut, around the base of their line. Just like, it just pisses me off. Just so annoying. Obviously, he wouldn't have done that if he wasn't
policy.
So stupid.
Like I said, Mattingly, I told you to trim those sideburns. You're off the team for good.
Yeah, so in
their policy.
Yeah. Well, is there a hipster moment of Zenith for you?
I guess this is not a hipster moment of Zenith. It'd be more of a hipster moment of Nadir, but just wanted to pay homage very quickly to Bob Wolf, the legendary sportscaster that passed away at the age of 96, lived a full 96 years. So God bless him. Wow. Bob Wolf passed away about a week ago now, I guess it was. 5 days ago, a week ago. But a legendary sportscaster, called Knicks games, Rangers games, called Don Larson's perfect game in the 1956 World Series, called the 58 NFL championship game between the Giants and Colts, considered, of course, the greatest NFL game ever. Only him and Kurt Gowdy are in the only sportscasters that are both enshrined in the Baseball and Basketball Hall of Fame. He was actually the first broadcaster to call the finals in all four major sports. Did stuff on News 12 for 30 plus years, did stuff on WFAN. He was everywhere for so many years. Everything you read, that he was a wonderful guy. And, just wanted to pay a quick homage. I remember Bob Wolf really from News 12, having News 12 on when I was younger. Obviously, I'm too young to remember him calling games in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s.
Thank you for letting us.
Yes, just in case anybody didn't know how old I am. I remember from News 12. I remember seeing his face, during the News 12 newscast and doing the sports, and never retired. Was always asked about it and said, "I'm not retiring. I'm going to do stuff until the day I die." And that's exactly what he did. So there you go. A little homage to Bob Wolf. Passed away at the age of 96. Yep, there we go. There you go.
All right.
If you want to call that a moment of Zenith, moment of Nadir. But there's my personal tribute, homage, Mr. Bob Wolf. All right. Next. Any more HMOZs from Mr. Hip?
You got
Bill Belichick related? Or?
Yeah. Did you see that? I don't know. Some like controversial shirt of a guy, military guy shooting a guy in a turban or something. Just Google it.
All right. All right, moving on next. So with that comes our, of course, final segment. As is customary, everybody's favorite, yours and mine. It is the hipster beer of the week. So take it away, Mr. Hip.
So we're going to go two shows in a row with Southern California breweries because I visited like a outpost of this brewery, not the main brewery itself, while I was out there. Firestone Walker. This is a name that can be seen in stores throughout the country. This is the opposite of Monkish. That you could only Monkish, you only get cans and growlers in the brewery itself. Firestone Walker, completely different animal, complete opposite. They distribute everywhere in the country, maybe even internationally. I'm not sure. And they're doing a series called Leo v. Ursus. And these are also getting distributed nationally. It's a so it's a series of IPAs. We had one of them when we went to see the 30 for 30 Mike and the Mad Dog.
That's right, we did. That's right.
I can't remember the name of that one. This is Leo v. Ursus Adversus. That's the one that's getting distributed now. It has a green, so it has, it's a can, it's a gray can, Firestone Walker with a greenish coloring at the top middle, I believe. And it's described as a big, bold IPA made for summertime sipping, hard-charging blend of Pacific Northwest hops, loading the nose with notes of stone fruit, pineapple, mango, and earthy pine resin. Okay. 8.2%. I enjoyed it. You can find it locally. And Firestone Walker, so, you know, they have beers that you could get on draft at, like, you know, a typical bar like Lupanic Distortion or Easy Jack IPA. They're pretty well distributed, but they also spend a lot of time on rare releases where they, or, you know, like they'll do like bottled sours that are like pumpkin and cherry and raspberry, like, so they do like rare stouts. They're pretty all over the map. And so when I went to this outpost, if you will, it was in what neighborhood was it? I think it was in Venice, like Venice Beach. Was it in Venice? I don't know. It's somewhere in that area in California. So they had like a restaurant, a Firestone Walker restaurant with all their beers, and then like a store. I went into the store and the guy brought me into like their beer room, like the beer fridge that had all these like rare bottles that, you know, you're overspending, like, you know, $17 for a bottled sour that's like rare or whatever, or $20 bottle of stout. But their stuff is good. I mean, for a nationally distributed label, Firestone Walker, we're going mainstream for a hipster beer of the week. Oh.
Oh yes, that's usually a no-no, violating the rule. No mainstream beers, because how can it be hipster if it's mainstream? Little touch of irony there, yes. Well, of course, the touch of irony is H in itself, so all right.
All right, so I think we're going to come back for the trade deadline recap. That's going to that's what we're aiming for our next show. So we have a rather important wedding in the meantime. And I'm,
yes, you know, for those
of you, all of you who are watching YouTube, I'm wearing the bachelor party t-shirt that somehow survived, and I didn't lose it throughout the course of that weekend. I'll just do a quick stand up and look at the image there.
Yes. Look at that. Look at that handsome devil.
Oh gosh. So we're going to be kind of tied up with that stuff later next week. So we'll catch you early following week with some trade deadline discussion for baseball and whatever else.
We'll stop and take a look around.
Yes. All right. Maybe we'll talk about some more Ivy from Wrigley Field and how much you can auction him for now. Yes. Yeah.
And don't forget, football training camps will be in full swing. Josh McCown, Jet fans, get excited. Yes.
Yes. Geno Smith versus Josh Johnson camp battle. Oh.
The one everybody's on pins and needles for right now. Oh, my God. I can't wait to see how that battle shapes out.
All right.